Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Murder 123. We're going to have a great show tonight, a lot of fun. We got a bunch of great co-hosts here, so we're set to have a good one here as we're getting ready to have better and better weather. And we're hoping we'll see some folks down in Myrtle Beach. So if you're going to come down, either call me or shoot me a message, and hopefully we can hang out in the sun fun capital of the world. And hopefully nothing will go wrong with coronavirus. However, we are all here right now. We've got a great show lined up. First of all, I'm going to start circling around the wagons. In the order in which you called in, from Emerald Isle, North Carolina, rough and tough wrestler, superb actor, Papa Stro Maestro. How are you doing tonight?
Salute. Great to be here. How's everyone?
Yeah, we're glad to have you here. Glad we're all just, you know, whatever. Now, let's see. The next person to call in was from the murder capital of the world, Harlan, Kentucky, Tony Filosi. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine, John. How's everybody else doing?
Doing good.
Fantastic.
Looking forward to this Jack the Ripper thing, you know. I mean, I don't want to make light of him, but I heard he was a cut-up, but we'll find out here later in the show.
Honey, that's the worst. That's as bad as my show. Honey, come on. You can do better than that. No, that's great. Now,
I bet you still got Zorro beat, right?
And that's right. And now from the East Coast capital of the Bigfoot world, the one and only Robin McRae. How are you doing tonight, Robin?
I'm doing good, you guys. Good to see everybody, or hear everybody.
Robin!
I had to finally just force it to come down here so I could see everybody. I mean, you know, just...
I know, hold them hostage.
That's exactly right. Well, I'm going to be back next week. I have a feeling they're going to
I'm giving you the elbow, Robin.
I have a feeling they're going to give me a hoe and some seeds and say, John, let's get this eggplant and cucumbers planted. And I'm going to say, okay.
Exactly.
I'm doing my part with the elbowing and the kneeing and all that good stuff.
Well, you do that in the ring. Okay. Well, that's all right.
Yeah. It kind of comes natural.
Yep. I can imagine it does. Well, now, the erudite, that means smart for everybody but me. The erudite, the famous researcher, the fine author, the author of the Hunger series, which for a while was number one on Amazon, from Jacksonville, North Carolina. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen, the drum roll. It's Dave Atwell. How are you doing tonight, Dave?
Hey,
I'm doing real good. It's great to hear a lot of familiar voices out there. Rob, very refreshing to hear from you, man. I hope you're doing well. I hope your mom and dad are doing well with all this monkey business going on. But, yeah, great to be on tonight, and looking forward to talking up everybody's favorite topic, death.
I'm sorry. That was too funny. Well, we talked about death last week with Charles Manson. That's okay. We got more death tonight. You got it. So anyway, tell us to begin with a little bit about Dave, the author, who researched the Hunger series and wound up writing about London, England, and Jack the Ripper. Fill us in, buddy. Give us the story.
Yeah, you know, Jack the Ripper is, you know, if you're writing any type of alternative history stuff, Jack the Ripper is just begging for it because there's no real wrong answer. If you were to say Cookie Monster was Jack the Ripper, somebody couldn't tell you were wrong because we know that little. We have that little bit of identification on him and everything, and as many different theories there are about him out there, we don't even know if it's a him. So it's a very fascinating topic. So, you know, when with my book series and everything, the first two books were in the American frontier, and the person that was the Typhoid Mary of the curse, so to speak, in the second book had to get out of Dodge pretty quick. And we don't hear from him again in the story until the very end. And that's when he turns up 20 years later in London Harbor, right around 1886. And the whole gist of the Hunger series is basically that that old question that if it's the best thing that could happen to you, but you have to do the worst thing possible to do it, would you do it? And the hunger curse goes around where if you feed on, you know, human flesh on a regular occasion, it's like a fountain of youth. It makes you better, you heal faster, better presence of mind, better resistance to illness. Hell, it probably could beat out this coronavirus stuff for all we know, but you have to live at the expense of other human beings. And in the event that you do not make that horrible decision to do so, you get what they call the rot, which is a very painful, horrible way to go, where basically your body just deteriorates, and very painful, very demeaning way to go out for doing the right thing. So, you know, this guy, he gets out of the frontier, and he's got the hunger, and shows up in London Harbor, and that's where the third book picks up, where the Jack the Ripper book does. This guy now, he went from the frontier, where it was so desolate, where he could feed regularly, and nobody would realize it, because when you're that far out and that far apart, nobody really realizes you're missing. And now here he is in a densely populated area. And, you know, Whitechapel was insane. People were stacked on top of one another during that period. And now he's got to feed regularly, but he can't leave this row of bodies laying all over the place, because he's going to get caught with somebody, you know, with it being as densely populated as Whitechapel was. So what does this guy do? He opens a mortuary. Absolute genius. So basically bodies, you know, you bring your Aunt Matilda in there to get buried, and he cuts off what he needs, the feed, and then he throws debris in the casket so it feels like your big Aunt Matilda, and everything's good. Well, from that point, he ends up getting involved in a triangle with a fugitive murderer from Ireland who is now in the police force, and a prostitute, a local prostitute there in Whitechapel. And as it goes around, we find out that Jack the Ripper wasn't one individual. It was actually one and a half, so to speak. So without giving too much away for the book and everything, it's not the conventional look at Jack the Ripper. So, you know, it's one guy walking around in a cloak and a big, you know, top hat and everything. It's a total different twist on the story. But I will tell you, the fact-checking and everything behind it, the only thing that I changed was a location where one of the victims were last seen. Outside of that, street names, names, times, weather, buildings, everything was exactly the fact. And that was probably one of my proudest parts of accomplishing that book, was the fact that I just didn't turn it upside down on its head like a lot of folks are doing with stuff now where, you know, hey, you know, George Washington fought, you know, George Washington put up the pyramids, and Jesus fought in the Civil War, and, you know, it. Sometimes folks take the alternative history a little too far, and they don't respect the actual true history of it. So, but yeah, the research, had I known what a deep, dark hole that I was crawling into when I started doing the research on that. It was, just the autopsy photos, thank God they were in black and white, because it was just what this individual did to the victim is just absolutely incredible. And, you know, in respect to the killings, it was genius work. I mean, for crying out loud, it was surgically done. It was done quickly. It was done precisely. And the part that always gets me is that how did they do it without getting covered in blood? And, you know, with a place that's as densely populated as Whitechapel is, you know, you mean to tell me nobody saw anybody with a nasty shirt or a coat on? You know what I mean? It's just, it's so amazing how precise these murders were. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know if people can do it like that these days. And, of course, we have DNA and all these other things now, but just the preciseness of the work was just absolutely incredible. And sometimes you kind of find yourself admiring the work, going, wow, you know, they really had their stuff together. But then again, you're thinking, no, this is not a good thing. These are murderers, you know. These are horrible people.
Right. Now, one question that I wanted to ask you, since you have done a lot of research about this, is what was the correlation between some of the, or maybe all of the Jack the Ripper murders and H.H. Holmes, someone that we have talked about before on this show, from the Chicago area? What was the time frame that maybe they overlapped or something?
Yeah, there's been rumors that he was connected to it. I didn't go too deep into the H.H. Holmes research when I was doing the book, because I had immediately thought he was involved on the outside. And as I've read and as I've, you know, researched and everything, it just didn't seem to jive. So I think he was already on the move here in the States. And that's the reason why. But it's fashionable to name him just because of the and again, you know, when I use the term genius when it comes down to serial killer, that is not a term of admiration, whatever. It's just a term of exactly what it is. It's just well thought, well executed work. And, you know, what he did in that hotel there in Chicago, I mean, it took a really, really twisted, messed up individual to be able to accomplish all that. And, you know, that's the interesting thing about these guys, you know, and you were mentioning Manson earlier. You know, I think any human being at one time or another might have the ability to kill, whether it be in defense, whether it be in emotion, whether it be in anger. It could be anything. Somebody breaks into your house, you shoot a man, okay? You come home, you find your spouse in bed with another person. Hey, that's emotional. You know, somebody jumps you in a parking lot. You know, those kind of things. We all, I think, have the ability when put in that certain situation to end another human's life. But by and large, that changes your life forever. You never, ever let that go. You never, ever forget it. For some people, they can't live with it. I mean, how many soldiers do we see out there? How many of our veterans can't sleep at night just because they were doing their job? But in the meantime, you've got guys, take for instance like Dahmer, who's got a six-pack of Michelob sitting next to a head in his refrigerator. You know, the amount of psychosis that marries up with the amount of genius And that's what gets your serial killers going. I mean, these guys have got to be very precise. They got to be very smart. They've got to be very manipulative. But then they also have to have that chip in their programming that, thank God, the rest of us don't have and are able to take other human lives on a regular basis and still maintain a normal daily function. And it's just hard to understand. And H.H. Holmes is a perfect example of it. I mean, that man actually built a building to do it. So if he's roasting in hell, he earned it, because that guy, he had plenty of time to change his mind, and he never did, you know?
Exactly, exactly. And that's, I guess, some interesting perspective on H.H. Holmes and maybe how things might have had a little bit of relationship over there with the Jack the Ripper murders and everything. But anyway, here's what I'd like to do. It's time to get the co-hosts into action. So we'll start with ladies first, and then we'll hit Papa Stro.
Don't start with me at the end. Start with me at the end, because I got to think about this one.
Okay. All right, Papa
when,
Stro,
when you said,
what do you...
When you said one and a half, when you said one and a half earlier with Jack the Ripper, it kind of reminded me of the music that Arnold Schwarzenegger met and Mars on Total Recall. Do you recall Quado?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It was the mutant inside the guy. He was like a leader of resistance. Free Mars.
Wow. That was actually a good movie.
Yeah, it's been ages since I've seen that.
Yeah.
Good flick. But...
Does anybody know the background on him? Like, what would motivate him to be the way he was?
What, for Jack the
Holmes
Ripper?
Or Jack the Ripper?
Jack the Ripper.
Ripper. Yeah, him.
Well, it's kind of a little tough at it because we don't know who it was exactly. And, you know, again, there's several different backgrounds. There was one, and pardon me if I can't remember the names, Lord have mercy. The older I get, the harder it is to keep up. But there was one that's a popular look that he was a Russian. God, what was that guy's name? And he was a Russian immigrant. And was over there, apparently had some type of background in medicine of some type or another. And he went over there and was somewhat, he was known as being kind of a creepy guy. And when this started happening, of course, being a Russian immigrant in Whitechapel, they were kind of considered the minority and the... you know, the lesser value of a human and everything.
Yeah.
And a lot of fingers were pointed towards him. And then there was a nephew of the queen. I can't, was it a nephew? I believe. But he
was it Edward? Was it Edward?
Yeah, and he was a homosexual, and they were speculating that he had an extreme hate for women. And that's why he went around, and the reason why he was able to make a way so quick is because he had somebody in the crown, in the royals there, that was protecting him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was another one that's a popular piece to that, which... Both of them actually line up pretty good. Both of them have their strong points and have their weak points, but there was just so little. And I had, when I was doing my research, I had watched a demonstration where they had a guy that weighed like 370 pounds, and the guy was huge. And they had him stepping. He wore a white lab coat. Now imagine a white lab coat. You know, you could see him from a mile off. And they had him standing in the alleys there at Whitechapel during the day. And he would take one step back into a little alcove there in the buildings and everything. And in one step, this 375-pound guy would disappear. You couldn't see him in the broad daylight.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, 375 pounds in the daylight in a white lab coat, and you can't see him. God knows what some guy is doing, you know, dressed head to toe in black and doing it at 2 o'clock in the morning. So,
would it be possible that he had the background in medicine and everything, that he, like, drug his victims some way?
Oh, I agree with you. Or stunned them of some type or another. And
well, if they were that precise when he cut them up and tore them apart, I would think he would have to have a medical background to be able to do it without turning it into a giant bloodbath.
Into an absolute mess. Right.
Well, he had to incapacitate him to get him to lay still, you know, because if they were anyways coherent, it's going to be a lot messier than what it was. And you know, from some of the photos I've seen, it was pretty messy. Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that that goes back to the medical background? Do you think that he chloroformed him? Or was there any thoughts on that? What did the police report say? Did they have I know they had several suspects, but was there one suspect that stuck out to them in their reports?
No, unfortunately, with the and I agree with you totally on the chloroform type thing. I still think that going back to what I was saying a moment ago about the being able to duck in and out of the shadows, if you have any type of ether-based chemical or something like that on a rag, and most of the victims were prostitutes with alcohol problems and other substance abuse problems, so I'm sure they were relatively easy targets just because they weren't of sound mind and sobriety at the time. So I totally agree with you on that.
Well, apparently it says that at one time, one of the people that were murdered, they removed half of a kidney and mailed it to the police.
Yep.
So if they're able to do that, they have to have some type of medical background.
And be able to locate a kidney, you know, because that's
under those circumstances in the dark.
Right.
The dark.
Yeah.
How many of them were murdered inside versus outside?
Gosh, I think it was 2 versus 3. I think it was 3 outside, 2 inside. One was definitely in a bed, in a room.
I know one was out on the street, it said, when they got hold of her.
That goes back, the guy has to be really skilled because, you know, he didn't kill her under a gas lamp so he could see what he was doing. And either he had to go by feel. You know, I go off the ribs. Okay, here's the bottom rib. I go over 2 or 3 inches one way or the other. That I have this organ. Or it goes back to the two-person thing. Somebody held a lantern, but if you're holding a lantern, you're going to draw a lot of attention to you. So I'm thinking that he did it in the dark, and he had this background. He had to be very skilled to be that precise under those conditions.
Well, they said the one physician that was, you know, suspect was Sir William Gall.
Yeah,
they said that was one of the people they were suspecting.
And part of the problem with the investigation, and I know a lot of the folklore that goes behind it is that the cops were a bunch of, bumbling Keystone Cops, Barney Fife type. That was hardly the issue. The problem was there was an ungodly amount of politics between the Metropolitan Police and the Whitechapel Police. And it's kind of like sometimes you see the sheriff's deputy and the city police having their little bit of rivalry. It was the same thing, but there was an awful lot of politics involved. There was awful lot of face-saving, you know, going on by the powers that be and everything. But those guys actually did all they could. The ones who investigated, they did all they could with what they had to work with back in those days. And it's unfair for history to look at them as a bunch of, you know, less than stellar people, because they were talented men and just, you know, was up against something that had never happened. I mean, it was unprecedented, the precision of it. So, you know.
Well, Dave, do they have any inkling that there might have been other casualties involved over there in London other than just the five that we know of?
Oh, I'm a firm believer. As a matter of fact, in the book, there is way more than five victims in the book. It's just those were the five that were found. And not to give too much away, because there are a lot of plot twists and everything in the book, but one of the killers is a female, and she's the prostitute that I spoke of. She has the hunger, and she comes by it by a certain twist of fate and everything. And now she has to find a way to feed. And she is luring men and women away. So the way I wrote it is that there were also male victims, but those were not the ones that were discovered. And there's even a part in the book where she goes to dispose of one male's body and ends up screwing up and gets covered in blood. So she's on the other side of Whitechapel by the water, because she was trying to dispose of them there in the channel, trying to get the current to carry them on out to sea. And she messed it all up and got covered in blood and guts and everything. So as she's walking back, what happens? She walks by two cops, and the cops stop and look at her covered in blood, and she looks up and says, "Oh, Justin just delivered another wonderful baby." Well, you can't really say that. You know, it was a Russian baby. Whew, those Russian women, my God. And then she points down at her shirt, you know, covered in blood and everything, and kind of makes a joke out of it. And she basically sold it off as her being a midwife that had just delivered a child, and that was the reason why she was covered in, you know, the guts that she was covered in. So, that's part of the angle on mine. That's that. When you read my book, it's not the traditional, like I said, the one guy in the cloak and the hat thing. It's actually several things that play out, and some of it was for the sake of feeding the hunger.
It seems to me that it just wasn't one person that did it. I mean, it's almost like the Jack the Ripper was like a header for all these other people that were committing these crimes.
I agree with you.
It's just one person.
I've often thought it was like Fight Club. You know, there's only one rule of Fight Club. There is no Fight Club. I wonder if there's a competitive. And you got to remember, too, in Whitechapel, back in the day, you ever hear the term slumming?
Yeah.
Well, that came from Whitechapel. And back in those days, it used to be hip for the more affluent folks on the London side to go hang out in bars and dives and everything in Whitechapel, the lesser side of town. In other words, you know, as we call what, the hood now or whatever. So, it fits the bill. You've got a handful of physicians and doctors, and all of them have this egotistical, first off, they're well-to-do. Yeah, and you know, they kind of have
to
say, hey, I'll
do what
we can
get
away
with. Queen.
Right.
Now,
she had his grandson there, but then there was also the doctor that worked for the Queen. But it just seems like the name Jack the Ripper, I keep getting there's multiple people. It's almost like they figured people just thought they could do whatever they wanted to do because it's all going to get blamed on Jack the Ripper. But I don't think there was ever just one Jack the Ripper. It was like a blanket name for all these heinous crimes that went on.
Yeah, because I definitely don't think it was just five. I think it was five, because there were several. It went for a couple of years where there was nothing at all.
11.
And then there was another series of murders that came about. And I think that it was more than one. And if you got one guy that's doing the work and another one that's doing the getaway, that's a possibility. I just have a hard time believing that one guy could strike with such precision and have such luck.
I just don't think it was. I think they all figured that everybody thought there was the one Jack the Ripper, and so everybody that was doing this stuff figured their crime would get blamed on this Jack the Ripper guy that's doing it. But there was never any one Jack the Ripper. It was just like a blanket name for all these people that were doing stuff.
Well, to have that, they would all have to be super skilled. So they would have to have close to the same skill level as far as taking out organs, you know. That would might mean
Well, I don't think they did that on all of them. I'm not saying that some of them didn't do a few of them at all. I'm just saying I don't think that it was all the same one for everything. But, yeah, they would have to, I mean, the one that took out the organs, I guess that one is a doctor to the Queen. I mean, he would definitely know how to do that.
And it would take somebody of a high, high level of skill, because if you've ever been deer hunting and dressed a deer, when you go fishing and you go to gut a fish, you put your knife in its belly, you pull it back, and what happens? It goes everywhere. Human beings, not a whole lot different. When the belly's split open, there's a lot of fun stuff that comes out. And to have the wherewithal, you know, me, I'd be the guy going, I don't know, which one is this? You know, why didn't I listen to biology?
And the speed he would had to have done this because, I mean, some of them, it was a while before some of them were found, but then others, they were found within an hour or maybe less of when they were murdered,
right?
Weren't they? I mean, so he just got down to business. You know, he incapacitated them, got them on the ground, put them in position, and then started removing organs. So, in the dark, you know, you think about the logistics of that, and how did he not get...
Highly skilled.
Yeah, and it goes back to what Robert's saying, is how can one... You know, I don't know there's not two guys involved, because how does one guy do that and not get completely covered in blood?
Exactly.
Does he take his jacket off while he works and then puts the overcoat back over his clothes? Does he, you know, how does he pull that off that fast and not get blood all over him? And Whitechapel at that time, if I'm looking at this right, around a quarter of a million people in 1888, and these bars and dives and prostitutes wandering around all hours. I mean,
well, there was another doctor. Yeah, they had that Dr. Stevenson, too, that they thought had motive, because he frequented the prostitutes and he got venereal disease. They said he was also a Satanist. But he was, here's the weird thing. He was a magician. So he would know how to make himself disappear.
So, that's
a great point, Robin.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, something to remember, too, this time in London, one of the big things that was going on was the grave robbing. That's why if you see a lot of Yeah, and they were stealing the bodies, and people were working on cadavers every day of the week. So, you know, you never can tell. I mean,
good, makes you wonder if that's really a rabbit they're pulling out of the hat, if you know. You know what I mean?
Well, the one that kept disappearing, my best friend, the magician.
Yeah.
Make him literally disappear, right?
Yeah. You guys, I'm going to let you guys enjoy your conversation, and I'm going to pop off. I actually have to leave at 5 a.m. in the morning. So I am going to bow out, but I'm so glad to hear what's going on, and I love all you guys. You know that. And I will be back next week. I just unfortunately have to leave early tonight.
Love you too, Robin.
All right.
And
all right,
see you later.
Good talking to you.
That's great talking to you guys. Solve the case, guys. That's what we do.
I was getting ready to say something. I don't know how well this will be taken, but I want to pose an issue here. It's almost as if the murderer was too good at what they did. Have you, Dave, since you're the one that's researched this, have you ever thought about that? It's like the murders were too perfect.
Yeah.
For a human,
I mean,
to have.
It's funny you bring that up, because that was something that when I was writing the book, I was trying to address too, is that it was imperfectly done, but it was perfectly told.
Executed.
I guess is right. So, you know, by the time there's a certain amount of, and we've talked about it on Pop Culture Stars, how sometimes it takes a certain amount of compulsion. Not comparing somebody like Tiger Woods to a serial killer at all, that's not my point. But Tiger Woods, the reason why that man was dropping 40-foot putts is because he was up on that green at 3 o'clock in the morning. All right? And a lot of people that we find that excel at things, everything else around them goes to hell, so to speak. So in other words, you know, he's out there putting, and he's out there on the golf course, and he becomes the greatest golfer in the world. But I bet you if he goes to his house, he has to have a cleaning lady, because if it was left up to him, the dishes would be stacked to the ceiling, because all he thinks about is golf. And that's the reason why he is the guy that he is because the amount of, you know, and you can use the word dedication, but then there's also the word compulsion, where you don't think about anything other than that.
And
right. And you've got to wonder, and going back to what I was saying about the body, you know, the body snatchers and all that kind of jazz, you know, you've got a group of physicians, and you know there's got to be some ego boiling around in there. It's just how it works, you know? And I mean, how many times you've been on the golf course, speaking of golf, and say, hey, you see that big old tree over there? Bet you can't hit it. The other guy, swat. And he misses it by a couple feet. Then the other guy says, well, let me try out. Swat. You know, and then sooner or later, one of the guys in the crowd pings it off the side of that tree, and everybody goes, ah, ha, ha, yeah, man, way to go, you know. You can't tell me it doesn't just happen on the golf course. So I picture all these guys doing these anatomical researches, you know, on these, you know, on these cadavers.
Cadavers, right.
And one of them looks up and goes, man, you know, it wouldn't take us but a split second to commit a murder, and nobody will figure it out. We're as good as we are. We're getting organs out of these bodies. And before you know it, the competitive juices start flowing, and
That begs the question, were any of the suspects
instructors at any of the medical schools, because they would have the rep, you know, get the reps in. I hate to put it that way, you know, I know it's not working out, or but they would get the practice in to where they would be that good demonstrating to the students and things like that, versus
right.
a regular surgeon that's going to, you know, he may be a great surgeon, but if he doesn't do it every day, he's going to be good, but he's not going to be that good. It has
and
to be
surgeon,
somebody that has access to
On saving lives, whereas a researcher doesn't worry about saving a life.
They're removing,
you know what I mean?
And they're dissecting, exactly. So I would
right,
lean more toward,
precision.
Yeah, I would lean more toward, because once they dissect the cadaver, they're pulling out, okay, this is a kidney. This kidney is from a male approximately 35 years old. You can see some signs of disease. Look at this, pass it around. This is the liver. This is the, you know. So that's what they do, because they're teaching a medical class.
Right.
So I would lean more toward it would be somebody at one of the institutions than I would a random surgeon that may do five surgeries a month, you know.
And I totally agree with you on that.
He's going in to stitch something up or fix something and suture it up. He's not necessarily taking out five sets of kidneys every month, you know, or every week.
Yeah.
So it has to be somebody that did this day in and day out, week in and week out. To be that
fast. If there's one common trait among serial killers is arrogance. Always feel like they're a step ahead of everybody else, whether they feel like they're a step ahead of the law or a step ahead of people in general. Every serial killer has that I am the man programming in them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so that, right, because he matched wits. He started sending letters to the press or the police that he sent the letters to?
Both.
But,
yeah, he sent the From Hell letter, and then there was another one that he sent.
Yeah,
but there's speculation that they were written by two different people, though.
Yeah. They think the From Hell letter, I think it was from the Ripper, and the one that was labeled Jack the Ripper wasn't, one of the others, one way or the other.
But, you know, and how many times have we worked with you know, in our professions, we always work with that one guy that kind of gave us the whole, the term they use now is sketchy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we always have that one guy that we work with somewhere along the line that just, there's something about him that just makes you feel funny. And, you know, the Christmas dinner and everything, you always tell your kids
right.
not to get near them. That just doesn't happen in your profession or my profession or anybody else's. That happens everywhere you go. And all it would take is for a guy with the knowledge, a guy with the arrogance, and a guy being sketchy. And that isn't real too hard to come by. You know,
And there was like at least 15,000 homeless people were in Whitechapel at this time, plus, like I said, the
Absolutely.
Prostitutes and all that. So he had, like, tons of targets. And getting back to, you know, the guy had to be really, really good at what he done, you know. And I'll toss this one at Papa Stroh. I mean, all the years that he wrestled, I would wager that if it was dark, and as long as he could touch his target, so to speak, he could execute some sort of move on him. He could flip him, you know, body slam him. You know, what about it, Papa Stroh?
Oh, absolutely. I've done plenty of blindfold matches, actually, through the years.
there you go.
And so,
there you go.
And that was the only way we could work in the ring, was touch and feel. You know what I mean?
Wow. Well, muscle memory You know, they talk about that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But,
so were,
yeah,
were any of the suspects, did they work at the medical schools?
No. None of the ones that were the prime, the Russian immigrant was pretty much looked upon as
a broke immigrant?
Yeah, as bad news, as a parasite, if you will. Then, of course, the nephew or cousin, God, I wish I could remember. Like I said, I'm about 3 or 4 years out of the heavy research on it, so the names aren't quite there the way they used to be. But, you know, he was connected with the Crown. And if you're connected with the Crown, we're already seeing right now all the hellfire that's coming around Harry and Meghan walking away from the Crown. Me, I can care less. I got bigger things to worry about. We fought a war in 1776, so we didn't have to worry about what those guys were doing anymore. So, but if you go over there to England, you go over there to Great Britain, people lose the sleep over it, you know? And so if something like this is going down and it is somebody that's akin to the Crown, yeah, they are going to make darn certain that things are managed. And if that's, you know, I've even, you know, when it comes down to that guy, I've even rolled around the idea that he actually was given somebody and they say, okay, you take him out in the slums because he's a creepy little monkey. And I don't want him killing one of us. So take him out in the slums, let him kill somebody, let him get it out of the system, and then you get him in the stagecoach and drive him back to the to Buckingham Palace. You see what I'm saying? It's
In the strange what love will do to you.
Right. And the last thing you want the little creep doing is killing you, for God's sake. So let him go somewhere and do it somewhere else, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it's – and that's the thing about Jack the Ripper. Going back to what I said at the beginning about Cookie Monster being Jack the Ripper, there's no wrong answer. If anybody comes up and has a theory or has a thought or an opinion, you can't tell them they're wrong. Because
that would explain the garbage can thing with Cookie Monster, him coming out of the garbage can.
But, yeah, I mean, it could be anybody. And it's just a darn shame that the cops get the rap that they do because they really didn't have the technology. We're used to these days where, man, we're solving murders that happened back in the 50s right now. You know, and the problem is they've actually taken the scarf from one of the victims, and the genetic information on it has expired, and they can't really do a whole lot with it. But they said had they had the technology sooner, they could have taken the garments from the victims, and because everybody lives, you don't have to bleed or spit on somebody to leave DNA. All you got to do is be near them, and you leave your DNA around them. So that being said, they would be able to take the victim's clothing, run DNA tests on there, and if they have a certain match from all the different victims' clothing, then they could track that match and maybe somehow or another whittle down the field. But, you know, the science just wasn't there back in those days. And, you know, hell, they were fingerprinting was still something that, you know, was discussed and was thought, but not even perfected at those times. So, yeah, the cops did all they could dealing with the politics. And that was just it. And you got to remember, too, is that Whitechapel, where these things happen, there was not a very high opinion of Whitechapel amongst.
Like Dave, what kind of population would you say lived in that Whitechapel area? That's the one thing I don't think I've ever found out. It kind of will help us put that area into a little bit more perspective.
Well, it was heavy Russian immigrant and lower class British. That, you know, and then of course you had mix of a few other things, but by and large that was especially the Russian and the German immigrant heading that way. But you know, and then again, that's another point, is the powers that be. Okay, here's a good example. You hear that a drug dealer has been shot to death. All right? There's going to be at least one guy in the room that says, well, one less drug dealer on the street. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, you've got the police, you've got the upper class, you've got the hoity-toity, what's the word I'm looking for, class division going on. And you hear that some drug-addicted alcoholic prostitute was cut to pieces in an alleyway. You go, well, one less nitwit on the planet. You know what I mean? And that's, to a certain extent, that's where a lot of that was, too, is that there wasn't a whole lot of resources being allotted to it just because of the fact that it wasn't deemed important to society. And you know, that was another thing too, is that they, you know, they've salted in there sometimes the speculation that it was somebody that was doing it as a hate crime. You know, where it was, hey, I'm doing, you know, Great Britain a favor by, you know, getting rid of one more addict. And even that's been speculated. So,
well,
you know, again,
I do want to add something. My friend Janice Carter, she was doing some looking into Jack the Ripper, and she found out that there were a total of 21 people who could have been Jack the Ripper, other than, of course, H.H. Holmes, and that two of the people, this would really surprise you, who were investigated included Lewis Carroll, author of Through the Looking Glass, and the Baronet of the City of London. I mean, they were going after everybody on this thing. So, I mean, it's kind of amazing. You know,
yeah.
Scotland Yard, I assume Scotland Yard did the work, correct?
Yeah, Scotland Yard was involved, but it was the police work that and that was where the big gripe was at, is that, you know, one side of the police said the other side of the police weren't doing what they should be doing. Some of the victims died within feet of the jurisdiction lines of the Metropolitan Police. So the Metropolitan Police said, not my problem, and walked away from it. That's what I'm saying. A lot of politics was involved. The commissioner did not see eye to eye to a lot of the rank and file in the Metropolitan Police at the time. And, you know, that was another factor. You know, so they were too busy politicking and trying to win the interwar there in the group to really, you know, focus all the resources on these murders. And, you know, I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of it. And that's kind of a cool thing, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, there are things in life we still have to wonder about. If we have the answers to everything, then time to close shop. You know, yeah. And I mean, every now and then something will come up about Amelia Earhart. You know, we'll never really know, but every time something comes up, what do? You stop and read it. Because it's another facet to the story, and it's a never-ending, you know, it refreshes itself, if you will. So, you know, that's one of those things. It's just the hardest part of doing this whole, doing all the research and everything, wasn't so much the murders and the guts and all that kind of jazz, looking at the autopsy photos. The worst part about it was researching the culture and finding out just how miserable things were for these people. And to a certain extent, it screwed me up where I was getting too much into it, and, you know, the sun would be shining and I'd be looking at it going, no, you know, we can't have the sun. It actually started messing my head up a little bit. But, I mean, these people had family members die, and they couldn't afford to bury them, and they couldn't burn them anywhere. So they would wrap them up and set them in the corner. So,
oh, God.
And it, yeah, and it was nothing. You know, the apartments, you would have entire families living in a one-room apartment. And when I say a one-room apartment, I mean a one-room apartment. And they put a little divider sheath up there, and that's where they put the chamber pots, you know. But you had everything from granddad right on down to the grandkids living in one room. And they slept on the floor, and they slept on top of each other. As a matter of fact, there is even documented accounts of people, like their great aunt is laying in the bed, and they're getting it on right next to the great aunt, cutting some Z's. It was just such a miserable, dank time to be there, man. I mean, that had to suck. And you know, and the real nail that drives the coffin into it is the fact that it was only 140 years ago, man. It ain't something that happened back during the Magna Carta or something like that. I mean,
and you nailed it, no pun intended.
There you go. I mean, Henry Ford was developing the engines when all this was going on. You know, think about it. We had phones, we had electricity, we had all that stuff. And they had a place there that was walking distance to London that had people living on top of one another. And as a matter of fact, another thing I learned during the research, a nifty little side counter, was when you had a family member that died, you know how nowadays you kind of throw, you know, you have the viewing and you had the service and all that kind of stuff. Well, back then, they didn't have mortuaries. Mortuaries were just coming around. All right? Back then, the big thing, if you were affluent, it was posh to have your family take pictures with the dead relative. Okay? And they actually used to have photographers would carry around these brass poles that look a lot like coat hangers, or not coat hangers, but hat racks, right? And they would set the thing down, and they would stick the rods inside the clothing of your Aunt Harriet and get her in a certain pose, and then would, like, paint eyeballs on her eyelids. And then the kids would get around her. Okay, kids, get around your dead Aunt Harriet. Okay, okay, this is great. Okay, go. All right, everybody say cheese. Poof. And you would take a picture with your dead Aunt Harriet.
With those eyeballs painted on her. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, look it up. There were actually brass positioning poles that and what was really bad is when I was looking at this, the child mortality rate was insane back then. And a lot of the parents had the children, the dead children, posing in these pictures with their siblings. And I'm like, God, ain't no wonder they got screwed up people floating around out. Ain't no wonder these murders happen if they got some kid that took a picture with his dead sister, for Christ's sake. You know, it's...
Hansel and Gretel, anyone?
Yeah. They used to have mourning dolls. They would take the hair from the deceased and weave it into a porcelain doll's hair to have a memento from the dead person.
Oh, God. Yeah, see, that's a bit much for me.
We investigated the case
around with them.
We had a
case. Oh, Dorothy, yeah. Oh, she would love this story.
Papa, now you got a story to tell Dorothy before bedtime, don't you?
Let her know, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Tell her I said hi.
I sure will.
Oh, my God.
Oh, she's going to love this.
This is just amazing. So I guess what we can say is we've learned a lot about the environs of London. City I've always wanted to. Well, I was there once. I had lunch there. Had a couple of those great beers. I really stayed two times I was in England. I stayed more in Brighton and more in Birmingham and Coventry. So. And what a frightening place.
I keep thinking about that pillow fight that Jackie Chan and Owen Wilson had in Shanghai Nights when they were over in England. They had a pillow fight with the girls.
Yes.
And they're playing that song. Da 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 da.
Well, I mean, just you know what fun we had. Well, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Why don't we go around the room and see if we all have any parting thoughts? I know I have one or two. We will start with our guest Dave, and then we'll let Tony, then Papa Stroh, and then I'll take us on out into the night, the coronavirus night. So, Dave, what thoughts do you have about your books, about this story, about whatever?
Yeah, if you want to check the book out, unfortunately right now I'm kind of going through a publishing flux right now as we speak, which we won't get into, but nevertheless, it's still available on Amazon. It's called The Ripper. The first two were Riding Frontier and Revelations. You can read Ripper alone, but for the full effect, for the full slap in the face, I suggest reading all three so that you kind of understand the flow of things because they all have connective tissues. So, again, Amazon.com, or if you see me walking the streets, I should have a couple copies laying about of Ripper. But, yeah, check us out. It's I'd appreciate the feedback, and I appreciate you having me on tonight. Rob, it's good hearing from you, man. I need to give you a call and catch up because it's been way too long. We miss you on Wednesday nights.
Oh, anytime, brother. Miss you, man, so much.
And like I said, I hope family's doing well.
Oh, yeah, they're doing better than me. Wonderful.
Sounds like me. I'm essential now. So I went over there to see my folks. It's kind of a sad story what's going on. I went over there to see my folks because, you know, my birthday is Saturday. I'm leveling up, hitting the big 5-0.
Oh,
and, early birthday. Yeah, man, thanks. I still got a couple days left to be in that 40s club, but it's creeping. But there's a guy that's been standing out in front of my house with a shovel lately, and I don't know what he's there for. But
do you have a hoodie on?
Yeah, it's kind of a tall guy. He's carrying around something with him. It looked like something you knock down weak with. But it's
he's not,
I had to talk.
I think he's like a plant a garden, right?
Yeah, that's why I figured he'd help me out with mine. You know. But, yeah, it was a little depressing talking to my folks through a window and all that kind of jazz. So, you know, I hope Shirley's not going through the same thing, and I hope your folks are doing well, man, because they're class folks.
Yeah, they're blessed to have them healthy and well, you know.
All right. Well, yeah, Dave, it's been great having you. Papa Stroh, your turn. Tell us what's going on. You got anything to plug?
Well, support my brother Dave with The Ripper and The Hunger. And In the Room podcast tomorrow night on VOCNation.com, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our guest actually is going to be Haku, the legendary
Haku. Wow.
Yeah. And, of course, Thursday night, WCW Retro at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So if you're not doing anything tomorrow night or Thursday night, come check us out on our respective podcast. Love to have you all. And it's always a blast being here on Murder 123.
Yeah, we love having you here. And we'll have
with you all on the Murder Show.
Right. We'll have more Murder and Mayhem next week.
Yes, we
really will. So it'll always be a lot of fun. Well, yeah.
I'm dying for it. No pun intended.
All right. Well, I'm going to have another conversation with Mr. Charles Manson, tour leader, tomorrow, so I may have some more words of wisdom. And the Beach Boys, what a great pair. Charles Manson writing music for the Beach Boys, how awesome. But anyway, so we'll see how that goes. But Papa Stroh, thanks a lot. Tony Filosi, what have you got to help us wrap up with this evening?
I have a question. Do you think, Dave, that any of the suspects that they have were Jack the Ripper, or that they were on the right trail at all, or he just got away? Well, we know he got away, but it's somebody that's not named as a suspect.
If I had my opinion, I would tell you that the Russian immigrant, he was the one that really kind of had me kind of raising my eyebrow. But I am more, I lean towards him, but I also lean towards the group theory, where it was a cabal of people that were a little too affluent and had too many connections and therefore did not get caught. Because if you don't want to get caught and you got the hookups, you won't get caught. We know that. The Clintons are out there, for God's sake.
That's right. He didn't mean it, Hillary. He didn't mean it. We want him back.
And Jeffrey Epstein's still hanging out with some people on an island probably right now. So, yeah, you're right.
Don't get any ideas, Monica. Don't get any ideas.
Yeah.
well put. And I guess I'll say looking forward to another great week of podcasts tomorrow night, the Charlotte Line, 10 p.m. with Brady Van Sickle and Zach Beechler on Wednesday night, Pop Culture Stars with Dave, Todd, Kevin Holland from The Walking Dead, and Liz, if she can be able to make with us. And Thursday night, of course, I'll be there joining Papa Stroh at 9:30 Eastern, and then 10:30 we will be having Scary Cast, frightening as it may be. So we got a lot of great things going on, a great week of podcasts. You can still stay in, be safe, and have fun with us. So thanks to everybody for being here. We really appreciate it. I'm going to skedaddle because I'm here in the Mid-Carolina studio, and I'll catch up with everybody tomorrow. But thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time on Murder 1, 2, 3. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
All right.
Good night, everyone.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
You got it.